Transmission start. Welcome to Where Did the Road Go? Join us as we wander off the path and explore lost history, consciousness, the paranormal, unexplained mysteries, alternative thought, and much more. We are present on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com. Now here is your host, Soraya.
So I'm here with Red Pill Junkie, the returning Red Pill Junkie, who's slightly more awake than usual.
I was actually asleep like 30 minutes before.
Oh, there we go. And Adam Sane from Conspiranormal.
I'm here, present. How's it going, guys?
So my idea for this roundtable is I'm going to throw some different concepts out to you guys, and we're going to see where they go.
Okay.
And the first one actually comes from, I was listening the other day, and I don't know what show it was. I caught it on YouTube, but they were interviewing Wal Thornhill, who's one of the main people in the Electric Universe idea. And they were talking about space travel, and Wal had suggested the idea that we are, at least in his view, electrically connected to the Earth, and we really may not be able to just leave and go to another planet. And I know there have been studies done that show that astronauts definitely have some health issues when they get too far away from the planet. So my question to you guys is, do you think that we're going to find that as being an issue, even if it's not electrically, that we're somehow connected organically with the Earth, and trying to go to places like Mars might actually have severe health consequences?
Well, let me go. Adam, you want to go first?
Oh, no, yeah, go first.
Oh, thank you. Well, I don't know about that. I do know that even if you discount that possibility, the idea that Mars has a different gravity than Earth will definitely be an issue for people who might try to be there for long periods of time. I remember reading one of Arthur C. Clarke's novels some years ago about how difficult it would be for humanity to try to establish itself across the solar system, you know, in places like, for example, I don't know, Venus, even I don't know, Mercury, you know, the moons of Jupiter, because of gravity. To the point that, you know, people who were born in Mars, or were born in maybe a station in Venus, will never be able to visit Earth for more than a few days. You know, I mean, gravity itself will be one of reasons by which humanity will divide itself, you know, in a very dramatic way, you know. I mean, they will become several species, you know. Martians will be probably become humanoids that will be taller than us because the gravity is lighter. I don't know, but if we manage to terraform the atmosphere, but it still will be, you know, probably with a low content of oxygen, so they will probably use some kind of breathing apparatus. So I don't know if you guys watched the movie Interstellar.
Yes.
I thought it was really interesting because it really showed how, you know, going to another planet is going to be really tough. You know, going to try to stop becoming an interstellar civilization is going to become way tougher than we, you know, have been led to believe because of science fiction versions, you know, that are too optimistic. Like, for example, I don't know, Star Trek, Star Wars, you know, you go, you see people going to different planets. As it's like, okay, well, here's a desert planet, you know, just you know, hotter.
Everybody speaks English on every planet, right?
Exactly. And nobody complains and saying, oh man, the gravity here is killing me, man. My sciatica.
Yeah. That's true. You never see that on sci-fi shows. It's never like, oh man, this is heavy here. I know Hyperion, when Dan Simmons wrote Hyperion, he had different races of humans that had adapted differently to where, you know, like heavy gravity planets, they were much stronger, but they were also shorter and stockier because of the gravity. But they were immensely strong when they were outside of that gravity because they had adapted so much to that gravity.
I would think that going to Mars would probably not be as huge a deal, since it's, if we're talking about, now I'm not very familiar with the electric universe theory, but if we're talking about somewhere that's maybe like in proximity, maybe we'd still be in some decent proximity to Earth, maybe if that theory were true, that it could still work out. But I would think Mars would be, I mean, the gravity besides, and the fact that it's mostly a carbon dioxide atmosphere, that, you know, if we were to go there, I don't think we would have as much of a problem adjusting to it eventually. Now, being that that's the only planet, honestly, in the solar system that's even remotely, or even could remotely be habitable, I mean, we'd have to at least somehow give it a try. You know, like Venus, if you go to Venus, you're going to end up crushed by the enormous pressure. And I would think Mercury would be completely uninhabitable. So I would see Mars as probably the only option. But yeah, when you definitely, when you're going out into space, as they say, the extended period of time where the astronauts' muscles will begin to atrophy and they'll have all, start having all these problems. Yeah, I mean, that would tend to be a concern. And then we don't really know, too, what the effects of the gravity on Mars would be on someone's body, since we've never actually been there physically.
Right. Well, I would think, you know, if you look at the concept of Gaia as the Earth is one organism, that we may actually find that we have weird health issues if we try to leave that organism.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, it's a possibility. It's a possibility.
You guys remember, obviously, this one of the classics UFO encounters from the 1960s, the one with Mr. Joe Simonton, you know, the celebrated alien pancakes guy, right?
You know,
I think about that episode a lot, you know, how there was these weird Italian looking guys, according to him, you know, and one of them like motioned him to make him understand that they wanted some water, right? And, you know, he goes and fetch some water from the kitchen. He returns. He sees one of those people like cooking something inside this weird craft, you know, some kind of, in some kind of like a flameless grill. So, okay, so then he also motions and with gestures tries to make understand that he wants to try some of that, you know, like in return for the water, you know, fetch, fetch, you know, good trade. So they give him that and they depart. He tastes one of those. He feels like tastes like cardboard. He keeps one to the Air Force Project Blue Book to be analyzed. They discover that is, you know, nothing really strange about it, you know, that there's no like alien compound. It's, you know, there's just made out of, well, one of the things that they discovered is that it lacked salt, among other things, something that Jacques Vallée points out in Passport to Magonia. But my point is this. My point is that you have these like alleged alien visitors who apparently didn't even bother to, you know, bring enough food, you know, or water during their travels. So it makes you wonder what, maybe if they're so light packing for their trips, maybe they don't even travel with their own bodies. So what if an alien intelligence, in order to try to visit another planet, sends out some kind of probe first, a probe that will recollect some kind of DNA material or something in order to create bodies that are already adapted to the atmosphere, the gravitational pull, you know, the radiation levels, and all the things of that particular environment. You know, and then
kind of sounds like the movie Starman.
Something like that, you know. Yeah. I mean, and maybe, you know, this intelligence, once those the ultimate spacesuit is created, you know, they just upload their consciousness to it. You remember the movie, the remake of the movie The Day the Earth Stood Still?
Mm-hmm.
The one with Keanu Reeves?
Yeah, and everybody hated that movie, you know, especially Gene Steinberg. Remember, he has lambasted it several occasions on the podcast. You know, I thought it was okay movie, and the fact that they showed exactly what I'm describing here, you know, the Klaatu is like virtually born into Earth once he gets out of the of his spaceship. Mm. So maybe that is, and this is something that I must point out, that Richard Dolan apparently also seems to agree with this, because he mentions it on his last UFO book. You know, the idea that maybe this is one of the reasons why the entities look either human-looking or maybe even reptilian-looking, because maybe, you know, for some reason we don't comprehend, they also utilize the DNA of other species, not just humans, not just mammals, you know? So maybe that's an idea, that maybe that's one of the things that we might do in order to become an interstellar spacefaring civilization, you know, the idea of, you know, tweaking and using DNA engineering in order to grow bodies fit for a new biosphere.
It kind of reminds me of a Onion article in the book Our Dumb Century, where it says NASA and hippies make race for the moon. You know, the idea that you can mentally project yourself and create a physical reality on another world, that's an interesting thought, Red Pill.
And technology as well. And that brings us to one of the other things I wanted to throw out there. The idea of being able to transport ourselves, like in Star Trek. What are the consequences of that? I mean, I guess in Star Trek they kind of just go with the materialistic model of, you know, you who you are is built into your atoms, and so you transfer the atoms from one place to another. But I wonder, you know, like if we did that, if there is such a thing as a soul or your consciousness that is separate from the body, does it go with the body?
Yeah.
They kind of played on that in The Next Generation. Remember the where I got some, this will show my geekdom here, but Riker was, you know, he got beamed back up, but there was a malfunction and left like a copy of him on another planet. So this other Riker had all these new memories because he'd been stuck on this planet for a while, and they found him, and then he went on to become a totally different person. So at that point, do you have like a bifurcation of souls, you know?
And I think with Star Trek, like I said, they didn't go with that spiritual concept, so that's how they got around it.
Sure.
But it's one of those things that always bugged me. It's like you see this happen, and how would you know? How would you know that it's really the same person on the other side? They may seem and act like the same person, but maybe that person's gone.
Right.
Sure.
You've created a new consciousness with the same body.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. A consciousness.
God, it seems like there was a movie like that. That was like a horror movie, and I can't think of it though right now. But it sounds very familiar to me. Like there was some movie that had that same kind of idea. Well, like they transported something, and like, but it came back as different. Something like that.
Now that you say it does sound familiar.
Yeah.
Well, there's Arnold Schwarzenegger, The Sixth Day. You know, there's the idea of the clones, you know, and they get like uploaded with the memory of the guy just at the moment of death, or just the latest memory, like download.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I remember, you know, well, a spoiler alert for this one, you know, the villain of the movie, you know, knows he's dying, you know, so he creates one last clone of his. And the clone is just like, you know, preparing the guy, you know, to try almost like, you know, discarding the body, but the guy is still alive. And, say, and he's saying, you know, wait, aren't you going to wait until I die? And the guy, you know, so, well, will you wait, you know? And that's when you realize, okay, so this new clone supposed to be like an exact facsimile of the villain, but he's just a copy, you know, he's a different person that happens to share his memories up until that moment, but will create new memories,
right,
from that point or onward. So it's complicated.
Well, how do we deal with twins, though? You know, because like when you think about it, they're essentially clones, although not perfect clones. But you know, in so many ways, twins share a lot of the same emotions. They know when the other one is hurt. They can have their own secret language with each other. There's even been twins that have been separated that have had the same experiences.
Mm-hmm.
Weird stuff like married a woman with the same name, and you know, all that kind of weirdness. So, I mean, are you dealing with one soul in two bodies? Are you dealing with souls that are just, you know, that are maybe connected to each other in a much deeper, more profound way than they usually would be?
Well, you know, they also did that study, and I'm pretty sure we talked about it on the show at some point, where they would have someone's close friend in the other room, and they'd be monitoring their EEGs, and they would have someone, like, you know, see a shocking image or something, and they'd notice a little bump in the friend's brainwaves.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was really tiny, but it was significant. And so you figure if that's what you get from just being friends with somebody, the twin thing is a million times that.
Right. Sure. The thing is that I personally ascribe to the idea that all of us are just one single consciousness experiencing reality, you know, through different vantage points, you know, given by our different, you know, bodies.
Sure.
So That's the way I resolve it. You know, I mean, in the end, it doesn't matter because it's just one consciousness.
Hmm. Yeah.
And I guess the same thing kind of questions come up when we talk about moving consciousness into a computer. You know, when we say, are we actually moving consciousness, or are we moving a simulation of what consciousness has created in someone's brain?
Since we don't really know what consciousness is, we don't really know what a simulation of consciousness.
Well,
the difference between the consciousness and the simulation?
And that's kind of what I'm saying, though. I mean, we assume that if we replicate like all the brain paths and create it in a sort of computeristic neurological model, it should be, you know, essentially transferred into that computer, but that assumes the brain makeup is who the person is and what is generating the consciousness.
Mm-hmm. It's, for example, when you are in a dream, you know, you're kind of following a different script than the script that in your real life. You are, in a way, you're a different person. You're not really in control of your dream self. You know, remember how you're in different scenarios and you're acting so all weird, unless it's a lucid dream, obviously.
Right.
But maybe it's a bit like that.
Hmm.
You know, maybe it's so easy to become a different person, you know, just under circumstances. And let's talk, for example, about amnesia. You know, people who suffer from amnesia and they don't remember, like, I don't know, maybe the last 10, 15 years of their life, then they turn it to different people, you know. Maybe the phobias they used to have, they completely, you know, they're no longer attached to them.
True. The and I've mentioned on here the show Dark Matter, and there's two things that we just talked about that come up on that show. The one is, this was, you know, the premise of the show, it's a ship full of basically hardened criminals who have their memories wiped. And when they wake back up, they don't have those experiences that turn them into hardened criminals. They still have their skill sets and stuff, but they don't remember who they are. And they turn out very differently very quickly because they didn't go through the traumas and other stuff that turned them bad in the first place. Hmm. So, you know, it goes to that question of how much is in genetic makeup and how much is, you know, experience. And the other thing they have in there, one of the things they do is they have a way to transport people, and not like a transporter, but what it does is it sends their consciousness from their ship to a clone in another ship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's kind of similar to the Cylons in the new Battlestar Galactica, right?
Yeah.
The whole idea of resurrection and how they would die and they would wake back up in a different body. Yeah.
And in this one, though, like if they have to return to that pod. They can have experiences in the clone, but they have to return to the pod to kind of upload back into the initial person to have those memories.
You know, since I already mentioned Jacques Vallée and Passport to Magonia, you know, Vallée also mentions a story of this medieval mystic by the name of Fascius Cardan. You know, he was a very interesting guy, you know, was somehow an alchemist, you know, a polymath, and one of the things that he did allegedly was to try to conjure up the presence of sylphs, you know, these, non-human entities that we might, you know, consider to be alien. So he conjures the sylphs and he starts to ask them questions, and one of the questions is about the afterlife. And one of the sylphs tells him that after death, nothing of the person survives.
Right, I remember that.
So the way one could interpret that is that maybe when you die, the things that you think compose your personality, your memories, your experiences and all of that, you know, they don't really survive. What survives is what, you know, New Age and mystic people will call your higher self, which is probably the self, the part of you that, you know, is present during altered states of consciousness, like, you know, when you have a psilocybin trip or you have a lucid dream and all of that. So it comes to an interesting quandary, you know. What constitutes you, you know, yourself, you know, am I my memories or am I something else besides the memories, you know? Am I the set of genes that make me behave in some respects the way I do, you know, I mean, or am I, if I'm liberated from the pressure of those genes, you know, am I a different person?
Yeah. Well, if you look at a lot of ancient cultures, especially Egypt, they have like the different parts of the soul. And I would think it's also possible that we're looking at a situation where our egos get shed off. You know, our egos are how we interact with this world, and it's a lot of our personal identity. So like you're saying, there's a higher self, and maybe those egos are what sometimes come back as ghosts.
Hmm. Wasn't that one of Elena Blavatsky's theories, that what we call ghosts are just like, she used the metaphor of the skin of a serpent, you know, that is shed. So that they were like, you know, the fragmentary, like, memories of a consciousness after it's discarded. Once that consciousness passed on to the next life.
Soraya, I think that the Egyptians had a concept like that, didn't they? Because didn't they say the three part division of the soul? I don't remember which one it was, but they said that one of those, I think, could roam the earth as a spirit. But then you had the higher self that went on to the underworld or whatever.
And see, and that makes to me that kind of makes sense that there's multiple parts of us. That we're not just mm-hmm. us, you know, because we do have, I mean, anyone who's worked with magic or had even paranormal experiences or altered states, you get that feeling of being in connection with something that's you, but not you.
Let me ask you guys this. I was listening to the Greenland Report today, and Micah was talking about people that have a head injury or they'll have a stroke, and all of a sudden they'll begin to speak in another language that they have ostensibly never spoken before.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What do you guys think about that?
I think that's really fascinating, and I don't have a good explanation for it.
Yeah. There was one one of the cases that he mentioned was this English guy that had when born in the 30s. So he was a child during World War II, and, you know, they evacuated children out of the major cities and into the countryside. Well, he went to Wales, and he was there, I think, for a few months, but he was surrounded by the Welsh language, but he never actually learned how to speak it, but he was around Welsh speakers.
Mm-hmm.
Well, fast forward, he goes back to, I guess, London. He goes back to the city, and he's an older man, and he has a stroke watching television. And then all of a sudden, after the stroke, he's able to speak fluent Welsh. And it was like it was able to but he had exposure to Welsh.
Right.
So it wasn't like he just picked this out of the ether. But it was like it triggered this part of his brain where Welsh resided, and he was all of a sudden able to speak fluent Welsh. Utterly fascinating.
Oh yeah, and there's a lot of cases like that. Where there is no good explanation, where like that has a decent explanation because he was exposed to the language. It's weird. It seems unusual, but it's not totally impossible that he picked up enough and parsed up enough that his subconscious was able to make sense of it, even if he didn't realize it had done that.
Right, right.
Sure. And because a more esoteric explanation is that the guy, you know, used to speak fluent Welsh in a previous life.
Yeah.
So the heavy injury managed him to tap into, you know, the life experience of that previous life. So he managed to speak in that language.
Well, probably as a child, he was probably about to the point where he was about to go over the line to where he was going to start speaking Welsh. But just that whatever happened when he had to go back to the city and he wasn't around it anymore, he thought he forgot it. And I know from firsthand experience that, you know, having a child that came here from another country that didn't speak English and then learned English. I mean, kids soak it up like a sponge. They learn so quickly. And it's like it's almost subconscious the way that they learn. Mm-hmm. It's pretty amazing.
Well, back in the late 90s, I was watching a lot of Japanese wrestling. And it was Japanese wrestling from Japan, so it was all in Japanese.
And I can only imagine.
And so I would watch it, and one day I'm at work, and these couple of Japanese guys come in. And the one guy couldn't speak any English, and he just starts speaking to me in Japanese, and the other guy goes to translate, and I answer him, not realizing that I understood him.
Wow.
Like, I just put, you know, I heard stuff enough and saw the context of what I was hearing without realizing it. And even though I would say I can't speak Japanese other than I know a few words here and there, but my brain must have subconsciously picked up enough that when this guy asked whatever thing for the computer, I just answered him, and they both looked at me and then said something like, "Do you speak Japanese?" And I went, "No."
Red Pill, didn't you learn English from watching television?
Well, not really. I mean, I did attend always good schools where they had always English as a second language, you know, so there's that. But the real kicker for me was listening to all the episodes of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood.
okay.
So that's what, you know, I used to train my ear into trying to, like, really get into the, I don't know, the rhythm, of English. And then, you know, I progressed from that. And then, well, you know, if you're as crazy as I am, you know, you manage to learn English by having imaginary conversations in English.
Well, that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It does make sense. Having a wife that's from another country, you know, I can tell you that when she was still kind of learning English at a certain point when we met, and, you know, I remember sleeping right next to her, and she would say something in English, and it was like it was encoding itself into her mind, you know.
Yeah.
It was a very interesting process. And what you mentioned there too, Red Pill, about the past lives thing, that could explain some of it, because, you know, I remember seeing something like Arthur C. Clarke's Mysterious World or whatever that show was, and talk about this woman that apparently could speak in some old French dialect or something. And they were, I guess, quote unquote, debunking it and saying that it was some kind of, that she had probably read this somewhere. And the thing is that, like, that's so amazing in and of itself, that our brains could be that, like, we just store all this information and it can just come out at the weirdest times. That's fascinating.
Absolutely.
I can also tell you that someone who is, relatively fluent in two languages, I can say that I perceive how I am or how I behave when I'm speaking in Spanish and when I'm speaking in English. Mm-hmm. And it's almost as if I'm two different persons.
Hmm.
You know, it's a fascinating process. A friend of mine, you know, a guy who I met last year, is a very famous author, Christopher Ryan. He has a fascinating podcast called Tangentially Speaking. So he's married to this woman who speaks several languages, not just English, but also Spanish, Catalan, Portuguese, God knows what else. And he says that he's almost feel like he's married to five different women, you know, depending on the language his wife is using at the time.
So in a sense, it affects your consciousness depending on how you're thinking about language.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, language is a way that you use to I don't know, not only perceive the world, but interpret the world.
The language that I've been exposed to the most besides English in my life has been Brazilian Portuguese. And just, I see what you, I totally see what you're saying there, because, like, concepts are completely different. Like, you have concepts in one language that are just not there in another. And it's like, it's just a way of, it's almost like a way of thinking differently in some ways. And then also too, you know, idiomatic expressions are another part of that, because there's things that my wife will say in Portuguese when she translates them to English make no sense.
Absolutely true. Absolutely true.
Mm-hmm. And when you have to think about it for a little bit, right? You have to think about it. Like, for example, she'll say, if you don't do something right or you do something halfway, she'll say, you do it like your nose. And all she's doing is she's translating that from Portuguese. It's a igual su nariz. To her, that makes sense, but you know, it makes absolutely no sense in English. So you have to like explain that to me, what that means, because I don't understand that.
Huh.
You know, I became a really, really big fan of Grant Morrison. And a year ago, I purchased the complete edition of his comic book series, The Invisibles. Which I cannot recommend highly enough. You know, I mean, Grant Morrison is one of those guys who is like Alan Moore. You know, he's not only a great writer, but he's also a practicing magician, and he seems to have, in my mind, a really better grasp of many of the things that we discuss here in the paranormal realm, that the so-called investigators, you know, who come up with these theories that are so boring, you know, and so, you know, so sci-fi, you know, B-movie oriented. But anyway, in the series The Invisibles, he discusses the idea of glossolalia, speaking in tongues, as the primordial language, you know, because he makes the argument that glossolalia, obviously, in a way, is a nonsensical language, but maybe as a primordial language is something that it conveyed the meaning that each person like needed, depending on their own subconscious. You know what I'm trying to say? You know
that?
Okay. Right.
So,
right.
It's one different, it's a single source, but gets a different meaning depending on the person. And now that I think about it, Paul Kimball makes a similar argument in his book, The Other Side of Truth, of saying how trying to compare the UFO phenomenon to a piece of art. Well, Greg Bishop was the one who started to think of UFOs as arts, as, you know, as some kind of like art manifestation. Mm-hmm. Because when two different people see the same piece of art, they will probably come with two completely different interpretations of the same piece, depending on their background, depending on their personalities, sensibilities, and whatnot. So it's an interesting idea, you know, of you there's a person receiving, there's two different person from two different backgrounds, from two different, maybe two different countries, who use two different languages, as Adam says, and they see the same thing, and they will interpret it probably maybe completely differently, you know, and I'm fascinated by that.
Right.
Yeah, well, it all comes down to our perception and how individuals see things so differently. And I don't think, you know, I think most people don't really think about it, and they just think that we all kind of see things the same way. But it's not just that we physically may not see things the same way, but how we interpret it is so different that it changes what we actually see. And so when you're dealing with the paranormal of any sense, it's so, I mean, you're dealing with something that's so ephemeral to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
It just makes that all the more out there.
And yeah, this goes back to your statement, Sarai, that I've heard you say many times, that if you see an orb in your house, it might be a ghost. If you see it in the sky, it's a UFO.
Right.
It's just a matter of perspective. Yeah.
It's a great point. Yeah.
It's what we expect to see.
Expectation, yeah.
Because if we're in the house, we're clearly not expecting a UFO to be there.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
A ghost in the sky, you know, back in if we go back far enough in time, we'll see different accounts of glowing lights being taken as ghosts in the sky, but that's just because we didn't have a concept of UFOs and spacecraft.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. In a society and a culture that we do have that concept, then that's what we see.
Yeah.
But it makes me wonder if there's other cultures that have the same, that are maybe, well, I hate to say the word, not as advanced, but they have different concepts and they have different ideas, and they're going to see something completely different. Are they going to see the same thing and just interpret it in that way? And we could just be doing that. We could be doing the exact same thing, right? We could be seeing something and think that it's, oh, that's a spacecraft from another world. But in reality, it's something completely different that we have no concept of.
Yeah, and I think that is the ultimate answer behind UFOs. It's that something we have no way of parsing into our reality.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and maybe it, the phenomenon, needs that interpretation, you know, needs that expectation in order to manifest itself into our reality, you know, choosing that particular, like, I don't know, form. I don't know. I keep getting back to the idea that Ray Bradbury with The Martian Chronicles got it so right in many regards with some of those short stories. You know, there's a story of the Martian who appears in the house of a family who lost their son. So, you know, appears as their long lost son. Mm-hmm. You know, they're so happy, you know, to it. But then their father takes the son into town, and then, you know, it's a big mess because then the Martian transforms into the wife of a man who lost his wife.
Oh, yeah.
The husband.
I remember that story.
Of a woman who did, yeah. You know, and the poor Martian couldn't help itself. You know, he was subjected to the expectations of all those people. You know, it's almost as if, you know, he was powerless to the way those people wanted it to wanted to see it.
Rip Hill, I'd like to ask you what Mexico is a big UFO hotspot, but
yeah.
are the conceptions of it, is there a slight difference between you would see the concept of UFO in the United States as opposed to a UFO in Mexico?
It's a very good question. You know, I mean, like you said, Mexico is a big hotspot of UFO activity that probably was interpreted very differently before the modern concept of UFOs arrived. For example, let's take into consideration the apparition of the Virgin of Guadalupe, you know, in the 16th century. I mean, this is Jacques Vallée talks about the apparition of Fatima, of one of the most important UFO events in the world. Mm-hmm. Whereas I will also post it at the apparition of the Virgin of Guadalupe, if you want to interpret it, that's also a UFO kind of a encounter, was probably more important because it managed to shape a whole country, you know, in this continent. You know, this encounter of this Indian, Juan Diego, you know, with this lady that appeared to him in the on top of the Tepeyac Mount, you know, and asking him to perform a certain task of him. You're not just like the lady who asked Lucia and the other two little shepherds, you know. And it's interesting. Guadalupe is many people say, well, that's a Mexican name, right? Well, yes. But it's also actually has an Arabic root. Hmm. I think it means hidden river, you know. And you get into the concept of paranormal activity surrounding bodies of water, especially cavernous, subterranean, you know, bodies of water. But anyway, getting back to your question, I think that what I perceive in Mexico is a more of a readiness to accept the idea of an alien presence in our planet. You know, that why not? Yeah. Instead of the reticence that I perceive, more reticence that I perceive in the American public. I remember that my friends Darren and Graham asked me, I think, the same question in their podcast, Grimerica. And I told him half jokingly how it was so cool for us Mexicans to think of some kind of presence that was more powerful than the gringos, you know. it was a cool idea to consider, you know. Okay, you know, so the aliens came here, you know, and the gringos cannot stop them, you know. How cool is that?
Go on.
Well, one thing I wanted to ask, though, too, about that is that, you know, in my exposure to Brazilian culture and how they are, there's a little more of an emphasis, I think, on the spiritual world. And there's a lot of emphasis, a lot more emphasis on superstition. There's a lot more emphasis on practices like, well, they have their own version of voodoo, which is called Makumba. You know, there's even the most rational person still has this kind of irrational fear of these things there. And they're much more, I believe they're much, in some ways, much more in tune with the spiritual world. So is there a little more of that aspect to the UFO phenomenon in Mexico?
I think so. Yeah, I think that there is no problem in trying to mix together those things. You know, the spiritual side and the well, some people still think, most people, I guess, think of the UFO phenomenon as extraterrestrial in origin. Right. You know, but you know how somehow, you know, it managed to make sense, these things. And well, let's not forget, you know, the influence of Jaime Maussan in the dissemination and the popularization of the subject. Yeah. You know, I mean, for better or for worse, you know, Maussan is still the spokesperson of the UFO phenomenon in Mexico. And as you guys know, 2 years ago, yeah, it was 2 years ago. God damn it, how time flies. I went to the National Auditorium to see the infamous Roswell slides.
Mm. You went to that, huh?
Of course. And the place was packed. And once the guy went there, you know, he was treated like a rock star. Everybody stood up and clapped and cheered, and you know, it was clear that to most people, I guess, except me, you know, this man was, you know, a hero. So there's that.
And then he showed you pictures of a mummy in a museum from somebody's scrapbook from the 1950s.
Of course, but at that moment, nobody questioned it. It's like, it's like the people were, I don't want to say hypnotized, but it's something of a, it's a weird thing, you know, of being driven by the events, the collectivity of it, you know. It's like almost like, well, I don't know. The only example I can come up with right now is in George Orwell's 1984, you know, when Winston talks about the minute of hate, all the people are gathered there, you know, and they're shown the images of the enemy of the state, the Ingsoc state, and whether you like it or not, you are driven to participate in that collective expression of emotion. You know, it's like a wave that sweeps you, and I feel that I kind of felt that at that moment, you know, when he showed those highly ridiculous pictures. You know, if he had shown it under different circumstances, maybe, you know, on a college auditorium with less people, you know, with people that were not, you know, fanboys, he will have probably received a much more different reaction.
You know, the 2 minute hate thing from 1984, I think that's Facebook now, but that's a whole other discussion.
Oh, you're so true in that. Yeah. I wanna go back to the things you were saying about how in Brazil they have this interesting you know, connection between the UFO phenomenon and the spiritual side of it. You know, right now I can think of two different things that I want to mention. One is this really fantastic artist, Pablo Amaringo, who used to be an ayahuasquero shaman, you know, but then he became like an artist. He became to make these wonderful paintings, which almost looks like Catholics ex photos. You know they're full of color. They're full of this intricacy of imagery that were obviously inspired by his ayahuasca visions. And in many of those paintings, he used to include what to our Western minds looked like UFOs, like flying saucers. Mm-hmm. And people will ask him, Pablo, why are you painting those flying saucers there? And he will say, well, those are not flying saucers. Those are like the vessels the spirits use in order to traverse from the spirit world into, the material world. Yeah, and that's a fascinating, a point there. And also how in Brazil, the spiritualist church still has a lot of followers. I don't know if you, Adam, has had the chance to see the movie No Solar.
No, I've not. Place.
That movie, I think, was released a couple of years ago, and it's a movie that is based on the book written by the founder of one of the most important spiritualist churches in Brazil. So it gives you a vision of how they believe the spiritual world, runs, which is some kind of like in between dimension between, this world and, other levels of existence. It's almost like, the dead go and they get transported, into that other dimension, and they, like wake up in a, almost like in a hospital environment, and they are like treated and helped and assisted by other spirits, and they go to like universities, and they're given like jobs, and they have like houses and that, there's still a correlation between that existence and the existence they left behind when they were still alive, to the point that in that movie they speak of how in the 1950s, because this book was written a long time ago, I think in the 30s or 40s, I don't remember, but the idea is that in the spirit world, in the 30s, they already had computers. The spirits that returned, reincarnated into the world, they brought back the concept of computers, so we could have computers too. You know what I mean? So it's this different, interesting report. You see the movie No Solar, and you see the city of the death. And it's almost like, something out of Star Trek, very CGI, very utopic, very new agey. So I guess that's why in some place like Brazil, intermingling the UFO phenomenon with spirituality and with, the voodoo, the macumba, the candomblé, and all those different alternative perceptions of reality is so easy to mix. I mean, Brazil to me is like, to me, Brazil is the real melting pot of civilization. I mean, even to look at the people, man, I mean, Brazilian people are, in my eyes, like the most beautiful race in the world. It's the perfect match between, the Caucasian race, the black race and the Amazonian race, and the end result is these beautiful, beautiful people with the bronzed skin and the dark hair, and there's no wonder why Brazilian models are among the most coveted in the fashion world.
Yeah, it's an amazing country. I mean, it has a lot of problems, it has a lot of issues, but it's an amazing place to visit. The spiritist thing, I mean, that's something that I haven't really looked into, but I know that that's a that's a rather big deal in Brazil. I've heard a lot of people talk about it, mostly from the side of evangelical Christians that don't like it. But they do have such a. I think that's one of the things that when I went down there, and it not first time I went was in 2007, and I'd never been to Latin America. And I, even though I understood it intellectually, I wasn't prepared for what, for, you know, just, it's just such a different world than it is here.
Yeah.
And I saw that in many different ways. But one of the ways that I saw it was just how much the supernatural was almost just a way of everyday life down there. We went to, I would say this guy was like a faith healer. But, you know, he was doing the thing, slapping people on the head. And I saw this woman start shaking and, you know, it was very strange. It was just a different atmosphere. And I remember one funny story. We were hanging out with one of my wife's friends and, like, one of their relatives, these young men, probably 17, 18 years old. They got this little flip phone camera. And they come up to... They come up to their mom and they, you know, they were taking a selfie of themselves, right? And they said, "Mamaya fantasma," you know, ghost. Mm. And I look at the picture and it's just like, it's just a crappy flip phone camera. And I'm like, this is just a crappy camera. But they were so eager to believe that, you know, and it was just, whereas we would just look at it and say, ah, that's crap. They're more inclined, I think, to believe, which, you know, I think can be a good thing and a bad thing at the same time. So, yeah, you're right. There is definitely just we talk about concepts again. There's just so many different concepts down there in that country. You look how active they are with protesting things and standing up to their government. here we just vote for Donald Trump. Sorry, I said that out loud.
They
feel so alive, Brazilians, right? You know, I mean, they have no problem in they're a very spiritual country, but at the same time they're a very sensual country. I mean, they have the carnival every year, you know, and they have no problem whatsoever with displaying, you know, and enjoying their sexuality in every way they possibly can. And but at the same time, there's also the spiritual side, you know, the spiritualist movement, like I said, was still pretty much alive in that country. I remember how from Brazil we have such fantastic cases, like, for example, the medium Gasparetto, you know, who used to get into trances and used to paint in the manner of death. Masters like, I don't know, Toulouse-Lautrec and Botticelli and Picasso and God knows who else. And there's also the story of Arigó, who was, you know, a simple, you know, guy who became like a psychic doctor because he used to go into trances and apparently was possessed by the spirit of this German doctor who died in the First World War. And he managed to conduct operations, you know, using the simplest tools, and not even using, or forget about using anesthesia. He didn't even use the basic concepts to try to sterilize the equipment, you know. And even people who went from the United States, the skeptics who tried to like. Discredit or find you know, if he was a fraud or not, you know, they returned convinced that the guy, you know, was performing something real. So Brazil, what an amazing country.
Have you ever been there?
No, but I hope that someday I will have a chance, because that's a place that there's a lot of, I'm sure there's a lot of things I would love to see.
Yeah. It's an amazing country, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well, you know, I think that's a good jumping off spot.
Mm-hmm.
And Yeah, as with many of these, we don't really know where they're going when we start. And that's the beauty of it.
Fun of it. Exactly.
So, all right, I thank you both. That was a fantastic conversation.
We're not going for two and a half hours this time.
No, we're not going 2.5 hours this time. But Adam, tell people where they can find you.
Oh, can www.conspiranormal.com, conspiranormal.com.
And this is
our conspiranormal.podomatic.com.
And this is one of those newfangled podcasts, is that right?
Yes, something like that. I've heard such terms bandied about as podcast before.
Okay, and Red Pill, we had a request that you read the phone book, so could you get on that?
Eroticphonebook.com, yeah, that's going to be my next website.
All right, thank you, guys.
Thank you, Soraya.
All right, and to take you out, we're going to hear Kim Bookbinder, and that's not how it sounds. It's a B-O-E-K binder. And we're going to hear a track called The Drake Equation off her album The Sky Is Calling. You can find her on Bandcamp if you like this. See you next time.